This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You're listening to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim Priester with Tom O'Malley from Irish Illustrated, John Bryce from Irish Illustrated, as well as Football Scoop. It's Thursday, March 14th, and we're at a bit of an impasse with spring football. Notre Dame, of course, practiced last Thursday. They'll be back on the field next week, Wednesday, March 20th. Of course, Notre Dame, the university itself, is in spring break, so they'll be back on Wednesday. We'll have five periods of viewing. Is that right, guys? I think that's
Correct.
And then have interviews with offensive line coach Joe Rudolph, defensive line coach Al Washington. Pro Day is on Thursday of next week. And then we won't have access to practice on Saturday, March 23rd, but we'll talk to Marcus Freeman on that day. So catching up, Notre Dame men's basketball exited the ACC tournament yesterday with a 13-point loss to Wake Forest. Really an enjoyable, fun, dig a victory out game against Georgia Tech. It's, I don't care who it is, it's not easy to beat an opponent three times in 1 year, and Notre Dame did it, but just not enough. I give Micah Shrewsbury a lot of the credit for maximizing that roster that he had. He totally maximized them on the defensive end. There was only so much he could do on the offensive end. Thank God that Marcus Burton and Braden Shrewsbury were a part of this team, because they would have been one of three teams that averaged under 60 points per game out of 351 Division I basketball teams.
Yeah, Georgia Tech was a lot of fun. Wake was just better the whole time. Wake was totally focused the whole time and had a good plan, because recently Notre Dame upset Wake Forest, and that still has Wake Forest in a little bit of jeopardy for the NCAA tournament. So that was a huge game for Wake, bigger for Wake than Notre Dame, obviously. But Notre Dame, look, it was just as big for Notre Dame in some ways, because that ends their season. Whenever they lost, they were ending their season. So I thought they would be a little closer, but Wake's a better team, and they showed it. Good finish for Notre Dame.
Yeah, I know.
6-4, yeah, right? Sorry. 6-4 finish. That's 6-4 yeah. Finish the way they played basketball earlier. That's
they were
good.
They were 2-10 in the conference at one point. They were 7-16 overall, and 2-10. They won six of the next nine. It wasn't necessarily against the best competition in the ACC, but that's you always want to be playing your best basketball at the end of the year, and that's exactly what Micah Shrewsbury was able to accomplish.
Yeah, 6-4 down the stretch. To good point there. I think it was a 5-3 close to the regular season with a nice little modest win streak sprinkled in there. What stands out to me the most is you guys just said it, playing their best ball at the end of the year. The player development, I thought, was very obvious as this team went on. Every player on that team, in my opinion, got better over the course of this season and over the course of their first 10 months with Micah Shrewsbury and all of his coaching staff. And the way Tay Davis played down the stretch, probably in mid-January, we're sitting here asking, what's this guy's role now? What's it going to be in the future? But Tay Davis proved himself very valuable, played absolutely his best basketball of the season coming down the stretch, averaging more than double digits for the close of Notre Dame's season. Huge in the win on Tuesday. Keba still needs to obviously work on his offensive game and some other facets, but they don't win the game without him Tuesday. He was 9-10 at the free throw line. Your biggest player on the roster sank 9-10 free throws in a must-win ACC tournament game. Notre Dame melted all the way down from a 17-point lead, but had enough resiliency to nonetheless still win the game after an 18-point swing.
I'm astonished. I'm pretty astonished at just the entire body of work and season that Marcus Burton had. But for him to, we would have thought he would have been just absolutely dead by the end of this season. When you consider what they asked of him, just a little guy getting bounced around, didn't get a lot of calls many times as a little guy among the trees, but his stamina and his ability to still play his best ball at the end of this season, I think is just remarkable.
He, I don't know where to rate him because he's the best scoring small guard. I mean, he's a better scorer than Chris Thomas. He is. I know. I don't care if Chris Thomas averaged 1 point more. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what he really, because he could score in so many ways. I know Chris Thomas could get hot from deep a little bit easier than Marcus ever will. But Marcus Freeman's stop on a dime vertical mid-range jump shot is phenomenal. It's also from the past. It's like he was brought from the past to play, and except he has the handles of the current. So I don't have to say this about a basketball player, definitely not since Connaughton and Grant. He's one of the best guards I've seen at Notre Dame, and he's a freshman.
And those guys, again, you all have better depth of knowledge than me, but those guys you all just referenced, T.O., had much more help around them than Marcus Burton did. Marcus Burton was number one on the scouting report, really probably from about the second week of November through the remainder of the season for Notre Dame. He was the one guy that opponents knew if they keyed on him and got him in foul trouble or took him out, it was almost impossible for Notre Dame to win. And we saw Marcus with four fouls on Tuesday afternoon, and that's when Georgia Tech regained the lead, and he had to spend a couple of minutes on the bench. And then Micah Shrewsbury trusted him, and he rewarded that trust. And I think those are, again, building foundational elements for the future.
And, T.O., it warms my heart when I'm not the only one that calls Benjamin Morrison Benjamin Harrison. You just called Marcus Burton Marcus Freeman.
Yep.
Did I? Nice. I'm not sure. A better basketball player than the previous coach, I think, though, probably.
I'm not sure that Marcus Freeman can penetrate the lane and shoot amongst the trees quite as well as Marcus Burton does. But
he's not a better basketball player than the previous basketball coach, though. Mike Bray was a player back in his day. So
That he was. So, yeah, I mean, we have basketball questions in the second segment, and they want to know how they get better next year. We'll talk about that at that time. I had an interview with Reggie Brooks, the Irish Illustrated subscribers probably have seen that by now. Reggie is just, first of all, he's doing really, really genuinely great things for Holtz's Heroes, Lou Holtz's foundation. It's really, I mean, you can hear the passion in his voice when he talks about, you know, helping former Notre Dame players and their families, and credit to Holtz for, you know, telling that organization, look, I don't want this just to be a good old boys organization. I want it to actually help the former players and help the families. And so Reggie was an incredible story in 1992. He couldn't get on the field because he was surrounded by an amazing amount of running back talent. The pendulum finally swung his way in 1992, and he averaged 8 yards per carry. The famous knocked out at the goal line touchdown against Michigan, and of course the snowball 2-point conversion against Penn State. Reggie was great. Tim, I know you, and John, you know him well too. Just beyond the story that I wrote, Reggie Brooks, the player and the representative of Notre Dame, I think he's done a tremendous job.
Yeah, he was my wife Jess had some events, including a massive pickleball tournament that Notre Dame hosted last week in Florida. And Reggie Brooks was one of the keynote speakers, and folks at that event absolutely raved. And Reggie Brooks really spoke in a very impassioned manner about the Notre Dame impact, what it meant to him to be a Notre Dame player, what it continues to mean to him, and how much Notre Dame will be a part of his future always moving forward, and that he hopes to, you know, help leave something behind for Notre Dame the way that Notre Dame helped him so much in life. I thought that was one of the fascinating things. That's one of the things that I've continued to come to learn as I've been here in South Bend, and certainly much more closely as I've covered the football program more intricately, and as my wife has gotten to become more and more involved with the university. They truly mean the 4 for 40 or the 4 for life. And it is different. And it's really neat to see when you see it played out, when there's a guy like Reggie Brooks that I remember watching, and then to hear his testimony, it's pretty powerful.
Yep. A few things about Reggie Brooks, cause I was younger than him and I was entering Notre Dame when he was leaving. I don't know if he's technically the best single season running back they've ever had. You can make the argument, but he was definitely the coolest because he came out of nowhere. As Priester said, I mean, he started at cornerback for one game against Desmond Howard. Desmond Howard got the better of him back in that game in 1990. It's amazing that he persevered. I saw in your article, Tim, that he mentioned, of course, he thought about transferring. How could you not think about transferring when all those guys are in front of you? And they're, you know what? They're probably all better too. It's not like he's getting mad. He's looking at all these guys that were awesome. When I was a kid, the coolest player in the world was Tony Brooks because he had an edge to him. And when you're a teenager, it's a lot cooler to watch a guy with an edge like Tony Brooks than probably a much better Notre Dame representative in Mark Green. But Tony Brooks was the coolest back then. Reggie's run against Michigan, Reggie's season. I was actually kind of glad Audric Estime didn't get eclipse his record because I liked Reggie Brooks so much. I would have been happy for Estime as well. But it was great to see Reggie that year. If you went back to weaknesses back then, you'd be like, man, they don't have as many tailbacks as they used to have. What's going to happen with Reggie Brooks? And then we'd have a much better year than Ricky Waters ever did, or Tony Brooks ever did, or Mark Green. You'd argue Alan Pinkett. He just had Jerome Bettis next to him, so that didn't hurt him either.
Yeah, Bettis, Ricky Waters, Anthony Johnson, Rocket Ismail, to some extent, a running back, Rodney Culver.
They made Dorsey Levens transfer.
Dorsey Levens, Jeff Burris, who ended up moving to safety. It was just an incredible room. And then for him to be able to emerge, of course, it was a 1-2 punch with Jerome Bettis in 92. And Reggie said that, you know, I had to score because we got down to the goal line. They were going to give the ball to Jerome. So yeah, that's right. If I was close, I had to get into the end zone, but it was neat. And for the Irish Illustrated subscribers that haven't checked that out, I would encourage them to do so.
You know, Tim, during COVID, I actually did remember we were looking at old games. I did a broadcast with Reggie Brooks, but we did like a USC game in 99. And in retrospect, Jack Nolan was the host, was the play-by-play, and we were the color commentators. In retrospect, we should have done a Reggie Brooks game. That would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a 206-yard game against Purdue.
Well, USC was the greatest.
USC was 226. He said he was sick that game. He said, and it was it was kind of a blessing because it forced him to dial in so much.
He had a touchdown in there, Tim, where he just kind of drops the ball. And I remember someone saying, like, oh, that's class. And he told me, no, that's exhaustion.
Exactly. 227 yards, 3 touchdowns of 55, 44. And 12 yards. And I know that the younger generation of listeners and Irish Illustrated subscribers don't necessarily know about Reggie Brooks's game, but he was listed at 5'8", 211. He was little, man. He was not very tall, but he was tough and blazing fast when he had to be.
He has great highlights on YouTube. They look old because they were I think loaded in 2000, but he has tremendous highlights on YouTube.
Yeah. Hey, it came up here that Tony Alford, the beloved former Notre Dame running backs coach, who's been at Ohio State, is going to be, or has been. JB, is that official?
Yeah, it's done.
Hired by Michigan. Yeah. I had a couple people ask me, would Tony Alford would he have wanted to come back to Notre Dame? I think that answer to that is yes, absolutely. And John, you would know more about this. A lot of this is being portrayed that Ryan Day lost his running backs coach to Michigan. Was Ohio State ready to turn the page on Tony Alford?
To 2 points, Tim, he absolutely would welcome a return to Notre Dame. I know that very confidently, and has looked for a potential returned to Notre Dame more than once in recent years. And as it looks like Dylan McCullough's career continues to ascend, then Tony Alford, I think, would have a great interest in returning to Notre Dame whenever that time arises. I don't know what the exact language is in his new contract at Michigan. I do believe it's been indicated to me he's getting a 3-year deal with the Wolverines, that it's going to pay him in the neighborhood of $850,000 to $900,000 per year as the Michigan running backs coach. So that's huge money. Also, yes, Tim, I think both parties had decided it was time for a change in scenery. There was a thought in December that Tony Alford would not be back at Ohio State. I think it got pretty advanced. Then I think maybe there was some feelings made up there between both parties. But yeah, I think Ryan Day has continued to look to revamp some things in his program. I think Tony Alford's elite. He's certainly recruited very elite, but those two parties, I think, could sort of run their course together.
Hey, and T.O., after the Notre Dame Ohio State game this past year, we were leaving the stadium to go do our post game work, and who do we run into? Tony Alford.
Tony Alford. We see Tony after every game. I think all three games since he left, we've run into Tony Alford. It's always great to see him. He was in my subdivision, lived there for a while. I have a very good Tony Alford story. Maybe I'll save it for at Halloween. Maybe I will save it for if Tony Alford ever comes to coach at Notre Dame, because I think people will really like that. Let's just say I was just being friendly and I used the wrong words, knowing what Tony Alford and Notre Dame were going through at the time when I said, "Hey, Tony, how's it going?" And someday I'll tell you when I said that to him. It was not going well. let me go ahead and answer for Tony at that point.
Yeah. Let's wrap up with, I don't know if you guys have comments on Nick Saban in front of Congress. And this is there's very divided opinions about this there. I think, a lot of times it's generational. I think people from my generation are a little bit more, maybe accepting of some of the things that Nick Saban said at Congress, because I think Nick Saban has given everything he possibly can to the game and his players. And yes, he's made a whole lot of money. And yes, it sounds like he's being turning a blind eye to, what the players accomplish for him. I'm not saying this very well right now. I did address it in Thursday Thoughts, but, it's just what is happening to the game is it's bad for the game. I put the game ahead of the individuals, and I think we all agree that the players should have been making money prior to this. We don't want that to be denied of them. They deserve it, but there has to be a hierarchy in sports, in a business, in anything. There has to be those that are in charge and those that follow the charge. And I think Nick Saban was speaking to Congress on behalf of college football, not because he was being selfish and couldn't control the players that were more interested in making money than winning games.
I think what stood out to me was Nick driving at what is supposed to be the fundamental foundation of the NIL. And he spoke about Bryce Young having a national deal with, I think, Dr. Pepper and with Nissan and some of the other players. Those are the things that that Nick Saban has embraced and said that he stands on those. And once those guys getting paid, he doesn't want to see student athletes become employees. I think that presents a whole subset of different problems and complications if it evolves to that model. I thought the most interesting thing on Capitol Hill this week wasn't Nick Saban. It was the comments of his former boss, Alabama AD Greg Byrne, and ACC commissioner Jim Phillips, who painted a picture that I've talked about maybe on this podcast, certainly on some different national radio spots I've done. It's economics. It's just economics. And when you start talking about revenue sharing and making employees and paying exorbitant salaries from the schools through their television deals, say goodbye to the other 14 or 15 sports, whatever it is that Notre Dame has, with the exception of probably women's basketball and men's basketball, and whatever it would take to be just minimally Title IX compliant. But the economics of the situation, and that's what Byrne and Jim Phillips pointed out, the economics of the situation will kill all non-revenue sports, almost all women's sports, and a number of men's non-revenue sports if this proceeds in that direction. Because again, it's not being discriminatory. It's absolutely fundamental economics, capitalism, and you only have so many dollars to go around. And right now, football, Greg Byrne said directly, if we didn't have football and men's basketball last year, we couldn't have paid for the $40 million shortfall in our athletics department budget. $40 million shortfall that they got from their football revenue and men's basketball revenue. Jim Phillips, the ACC commissioner, said, if this moves forward like this, if we make them employees and turn it into a revenue sharing model, you will see programs literally within a year. You will see institutions literally within a year go from 28 sports being offered to 6 sports being offered. And he outlined a scenario where it would be football and probably men's basketball. That's around 98 scholarships. And then you would have 4 women's teams with the equivalent of 98 scholarships, and everything else would basically turn into club sports and have to be self-funded.
No, I mentioned this and I might harp on it too much, but if you have a very poor employee, Tim and John and Jack, what do you do with poor employees that don't produce what you need?
Certainly don't promote them.
You know what? So if you want, I mean, if it goes to being employees and get everybody, and I mean, people are all getting paid, but if you're officially getting paid and you're an employee, what is the point of keeping you if you're not good? Why in the world would someone keep somebody on their football team if he's not good enough? Why would you pay a single penny to someone that's not helping your team win when you could go get someone that could help your team win? So get ready to get cut is one thing that would happen if people are employees, because that's what you do to employees that underperform. But I was on a radio. It's so out of hand. I was on a radio station, just a phone call with a radio station host in the SEC. And he was talking about how their NIL is a mess because guys aren't getting paid. Like, some guys are making $800,000 basketball NIL in the SEC and they're not seeing the money. Like, this is going to be a huge problem. Like, I'll give credit to Notre Dame. That's not happened at Notre Dame with fund and with other people that help out. It's just going to get so much worse. You have to regulate it somehow. And I am all for people getting paid. And the one thing I will say in defense of people that are screaming at Nick Saban, he was more than happy to leave Miami when it wasn't working out for him. So players could be more than happy to leave somewhere else too. I mean, Nick Saban was pretty happy at Alabama. That's why he didn't leave. If Nick Saban was stuck at Troy first, he might have left for greener pastures too, on the spot whenever he felt like it. But man, it's gonna be tough. I don't know why you're gonna be able to maintain a one-time transfer rule, because you just get a waiver. And who says that's wrong if you want to transfer somewhere else? What if you lose your coach? Tim, didn't I tell you offline that I heard, of all people, Mike Greenberg was talking about a college football, but he said it was in 2021, there were 20 coaches hired. Two of them are still at the job.
Wow.
You're in college with those guys. You came in 2021 as a freshman. You're a senior. That's insane. That's just insane.
It's, you know, I'm just concerned for the game itself. I you want individuals to benefit. But I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's hurting the game and it's going to hurt the game more.
It is. Sure. Guys skipping bowl games, they're going to start skipping games in November, man. If you're not on a playoff team, and then we've even started to see, I guess, partly because of entering the transfer portal, guys got to enter the portal before their season's even over if you're going into the postseason. Anyway, we could go on and on about this, which we are. We're going to come back with a bunch of questions from our readers, burning up the boards in segment two.
Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question comes from Hayden Adams Z. It's always something with ND's wide receiver position: inexperience, overhype, a shallow rotation, not enough development, too many slot receivers, fifth metatarsals, hamstrings, etc. Why will this year be any different? Because I'm not yet ready to be let down again.
I love the inclusion of fifth metatarsals. hamstrings are, that's the nature of the position to a large extent. But I mean, I get that, but. And Tim, you just wrote a story about Notre Dame has seven wide receivers with previous starting experience, which is,
I don't think it's ever happened before at Notre Dame.
Well, you've got the transfer portal, and that's why they're in that situation. But I get it if you're going to go ahead and doubt it. But we went to practice last Thursday, and we saw a lot of good college wide receivers running around out there. Whether that will materialize into a great passing game with Riley Leonard and or Steve Angeli or not. But Jaden Harrison looks really good. You've seen Jordan Faison. Chris Mitchell has proven himself. Jaden Greathouse, I thought, looked great the other day. So did Jaden Thomas. Deion Colsey looked to be in his best shape. We're not even including Bo Collins and Logan Saldate. Did I say Micah Gilbert, K.K. Smith, and Cam Williams? I mean, just a sheer numbers kind of thing that they should be better.
Yeah, I get the skepticism, but believe in numbers. And the numbers tell you to believe it's going to be different just because there's that volume of numbers. And T.O. so clearly illuminated it in his story. There's never been that volume of numbers, not with starting experience. There certainly hasn't been this depth since I've been around the last half dozen or so, season 6, 8, whatever it is. So believe in the numbers. Don't believe in practice video clips of 30 seconds or whatever. Just believe in the sheer numbers. Gives Notre Dame every chance to be so much better than it has been at the wide receiver position.
They do have a lot of good slot receivers, though. I will add that could be a issue, but it's not an issue when they're all good. It's just an issue for the guy that doesn't get to play as much. Yeah, and I'll be, hey, Tony Alford. It's Tony Alford's podcast. It's not Happy Camp.
There's enough flexibility though in today's game. It used to be more strict. Stick to your role and your spot. It's much more.
The problem is Jaden Thomas, Tim. Jaden Thomas is such a good blocker from the slot position. You're like, keep your big body over there on the boundary. We have slot receivers, but no, he can go block and he can actually add to your offense.
Well, Greathouse is improving in that regard. Here's what Mike Brown's going to have to prove that he can do. He's going to have to adopt the Dylan McCullough model. Dylan keeps all those running backs relatively happy. How will Notre Dame keep all of these wide receivers engaged beyond just getting them to block and play a role? Guys are going to have niche roles, and they're going to have to embrace having niche roles.
I think it's easier with receivers because, you know, game day for them, they're running all over the field.
Yeah.
So I think it's a little bit easier to, you know, plug and play and take a guy out, let him get a break and run him back in there. But I, you know, I'm really looking forward to it. I get this skepticism, Hayden, Adam Z. But the film don't lie. Watching them practice last Thursday, it doesn't lie. It doesn't guarantee that they're going to be a lot better, but they've got an excellence. The percentages are much greater that they're going to be improved at wide receiver.
Hayden Adam Z is an ND grad and a Lexington guy. So he should just start focusing on basketball for a little couple of weeks here and he'll be happy. Next question from Coach Aguilar, which is not to be confused with Rick Aguilera. What would these three careers look like if they met their full potential? Luke Talich, Kenny Binchy, and Jaden Osbury. Great submissions by.
Yeah, I thought so too. I really like this question because it wasn't another Rocco Spindler question or something along those lines. No, it's guys a little bit more on the fringe. I think we all feel like Jaden Osbury is going to be a really good linebacker for Notre Dame. And it'll be interesting to see how much he gets on the field this year, what role he plays, because he has a inside outside skill set where he can play. Luke Talich, I mean, I really like him. His length is real. I don't know how much of a physical enforcer he's going to be on the back end, but I love his length, his wingspan. I think that he can play a significant role against the deep ball and patrolling back there. And Kenny Minchie is kind of at the mercy of the competition a little bit. Marcus Freeman even said the other day that, you know, Kenny Minchie and CJ Carr are kind of competing with each other. And Steve Angeli and Riley Leonard are competing on a little bit higher level because that's where they are right now. But it's harder for me to speculate about Kenny Minchie because I think it's so dependent upon the people around him and the competition.
Yeah, when I read that question, it is a good one. I like all three of those names. He doesn't specify what will the full measure of their careers look like at Notre Dame. He just says potential. And so I think what we've all witnessed in the last couple of years is, as just this week, Drew Pine committed to Missouri, is that the quarterback position, it's harder than anywhere else on the field, probably harder than any other spot in college athletics to maintain depth. I think Jaden Osbury has a tremendous ceiling, maybe the highest ceiling of those three because of what we've already seen him flash. And I think the natural abilities there, along with what I believe all three of us think is a very high football IQ. Luke Talich, I think maximizing his career would be he's a rotational safety and a core special teams guy. And that's what I think he'll be able to do.
I think Kenny Minchie should play the waiting game to see what Steve Angeli does. But yeah, Kenny Minchie's realistic career potential is elsewhere because if everybody waits it out, he is stuck in a little bit of a sandwich with Steve Angeli and CJ Carr there. But I mean, he's a victim of the circumstances, but I mean, he could just go out and be better too. If he's way better than Steve Angeli, he should play over. that is exactly what should happen. Luke Talich, I think his full potential would be upperclassman starter. So not soon, upperclassman starter. Jaden Osbury's full potential is probably 2.5-year starter and doesn't bother with a fifth. Full potential.
Yeah, I was going to start.
Already has, Talich has already played special teams. So to that end, I think he's a special team starter much sooner. But yeah, Tim, as you say, upperclassman starter, I said rotational. They use multiple guys on the back end. Yeah. But certainly I see him having the potential to be a starter in the back end as long as he continues to develop. I mean, look, I spent a lot of time at Utah last summer on a college tours set of features that I did for Football Scoop. And they have a very meticulous form of recruiting guys to fit the Utah system and how they identify them. And Luke Talich was a guy they identified and had extreme interest in, and he chose to initially walk on at Notre Dame and then earn that scholarship.
And to your point, Tim, I think Talich and Osbury have a much better chance of ending their college careers at Notre Dame than just because of the situation and the position in particular. We have a question from longtime question submitter, CMU Pens fan. In your eyes, what would a healthy Rocco Spindler have to do to win his job back?
He would have to beat out Billy Schroth or Pat Coogan. Next question, or is that too simple?
I think that's perfect. Yeah, he would have to prove he's better than the other guys in front of him on the depth chart. It's as simple as that.
Do you guys anticipate that he'll do that?
I would have a different opinion of Spindler in the competition if he didn't have to come back from a knee injury, because I think he was just a little bit – they were already starting to rotate him out a little bit, and then he got hurt, so that's a little harder.
Well, if he hadn't gotten hurt, the question would be about Billy Schroth.
Well, he did rotate out a little, though. Like, Rocco Spindler started to rotate out in that Louisville game. Remember, we looked down, all of a sudden there's different guards and different centers, and we're like, what in the world is going on down
there? I think it would have been – a much more open competition going into spring had Spindler stayed healthy, but I think it was going to be an open competition either way. Now I think Spindler has the most ground to make up.
Spindler, look, I talked about it for literally years that I didn't think that he was going to emerge, and it was based upon feedback. It was based upon feedback from people that would know. Things change, coaches change. I think we are all surprised that Spindler beat out Billy Schroth, but he was a year older. I thought he did some good things. I think there's a tendency with offensive linemen that when they blow a block, it's magnified like that's been going on all day, and that's not
right.
necessarily the reality. I think Rocco Spindler had more bad plays than Pat Coogan. There's no doubt in my mind about that. I think Pat Coogan, as I've said before, was very underrated in his overall performance last year. He wasn't perfect. He had bad plays too. He was a first-time starter, but I think he was more consistent than Spindler. And then once Spindler had that injury, it opened the door for Billy Schroth. And Billy Schroth is such a good prospect that it's just going to be very difficult for him to be beaten out at this point.
I think we all were glad for Spindler last year. Remember when he came and talked to us? And
he was great. He was
so focused on. There was no whining about not playing yet. There was nothing about how hard it was. It was just
I really respected him for that. Yeah, absolutely. Question from Whiskey Jack 46. I don't know that we've had a question from him before. Will Notre Dame be practicing with helmet communication during the spring to prepare for use this coming fall?
So I have a little bit of insight here in that Notre Dame actually practiced for its bowl game with helmet communication, but both teams had to consent to using the helmet communication. It's my understanding that Oregon State did not wish to use the helmet communication, and therefore Notre Dame did not use the helmet communication in its bowl game. But this is something that this coaching staff, to its credit, has already embraced, already tried to implement, and will continue to try to implement in the coming weeks and months until that August 31st opener.
I imagine they'll dabble with it through the spring and then really ramp it up.
Yeah, look, they've been advanced. I've asked Marcus about this in the past. They've been pretty advanced already with some of their headset communication, just with the coaches and some of the assistants to try and maximize the efficiency on the practice field. So that's something that stood out to me specifically couple of years.
How so? Can you be specific about that?
Yeah, you just see them. You see far more coaches involved on the headsets, and I think it helps on-field communication on practice because you have all the coaches, instead of screaming saying, hey, we're doing this or doing that, they're able to talk across the headsets, and then the coaches of the respective positions are able to, I think, more clearly and articulate what they're trying to do and what they need done to their players at their respective positions.
Next question is from Tater's Dad One. I see other defensive ends visiting. Is Damian Shanklin a take no matter what? I could go ahead and answer this one too. Or could him playing the long game play him out of a scholarship?
I think he's a great prospect. I think you give him a long, long leash. I really want to see him in a Notre Dame uniform. He's the lineman that I want to see in a Notre Dame uniform on the defensive side. And Jack Lang's the guy on the offensive side. Competition will be great. I think Damian Shanklin is a difference maker at defensive end. You do not get defensive end, Viper / athletes like that at Notre Dame very often. Thus, you give him a longer leash. You hope that he doesn't want to use the length of that leash for too long, so to speak.
JB, I think he's a take at all times.
He's a take. Like he's a take if he comes to you at the end of November and something's changed in his recruitment, you find a spot for him then. Like he's just
plus
a guy.
Always spots.
Right. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. There's always spots, especially with the portal. But my point is he's the potential. He's a guy that whenever he could commit to you would make you forecast your roster better. And so to me, that makes him a take at any point in time. As you alluded to, Tim, you would like for him to be a take that you then have to hold on to rather than a guy you keep hoping that you get to take.
Hey, guys, if we do a spinoff podcast, you want to name it There's Always Room, Both is Always the Answer, or I Just Want to Cut Someone That Can't Play. Those are my three names, I think.
You're the king of this, man, so you name it.
There's Always Room is the kinder way of saying the other thing. So there's always room, man. Just take them.
From MLB77. Now that the courts have permitted NIL free agency, what is the likelihood that Marcus Burton and Hannah Hidalgo are both in Irish uniforms next year?
I'll say I like the likelihood of both, just because I think Notre Dame is already being very proactive with both. I feel pretty confident in saying that. I think that Notre Dame is trying to raise more funds for women's NIL. It's a real thing. I think both have already probably had some entreaties from third parties to see if they're going to go into the portal. But Marcus Burton showed you he was going to stick with Notre Dame after he committed to Bray and stayed through with Shrews. And I think that, it's no accident the way that Notre Dame has promoted Hannah Hidalgo in recent weeks from the Hannah's Hoops website and earrings that they gave out. I tweeted out a picture of those to just some of the things that they've done to more proactively market their people. Ashton Pollard, head of women's sports information, has done a really nice job with a lot of that. So I just think you're seeing Notre Dame very aware that they're going to have to find some NIL money for those two players specifically, probably Olivia Miles as well. And I think you're seeing Notre Dame trying to find that money to ensure that they keep both those standout young basketball players.
I'd be more concerned about Burton if he were from Wilmington, Scottsdale, Austin, or something like Atlanta, or something along those lines. There should probably be a hometown discount. I wrote about it in Monday Musings. Remember Pete Sampson said in our last podcast that Wake Forest and Duke and ACC teams are the farm systems for Notre Dame football? Yeah, see Cormac Ryan win an ACC championship. North Carolina and Duke can farm a lot of people out of Notre Dame basketball if they want to.
Yeah, you know, I wrote about okay, somebody brought this up to me the other day. What is to prevent, and why wouldn't Louisville, who just fired Kenny Payne, offer Micah Shrewsbury the head coaching job?
Oh, they will. They will.
He's from Indiana, so I mean it's just right across the border. He would probably take Marcus Burton and his son with him.
That would lose Marcus Burton for sure.
Yes, at the least. I actually wrote about this and was going to put it in Thursday Thoughts, and I thought, you know what? It's not worth it because I'm just speculating and I'm not going to go there. Yeah. I thought, well, you know what? I'll go ahead and bring it up in our podcast.
I had a national writer bring up IU and Louisville jobs when they come up for watching out for Shrews.
Yeah, yeah. I bet
they
do.
Don't know. Yeah, and a lot of times I have a little bit more effectiveness on learning the buyout language on football contracts than I do on basketball. I don't have a clue as to the buyout language on Micah Shrewsbury's contract, but perhaps I can try to do some digging and see what we can unearth there.
To answer the question, I would say that it's more likely that Burton and Hidalgo are back next year.
Yeah.
It's 2024 in college athletics, and the rules have been thrown out the door. So
it would hurt a lot more than the last time they lost an up-and-coming coach to a one-year deal in basketball. Lot more.
Matt Doherty got people excited, drove the players crazy. And then left.
Hey, Tim, do you guys know about that? I got to find the shirt online that Duke students had for Doherty's first game at Cameron when he was coaching North Carolina. They had a shirt with seven former North Carolina players' names on it with X's in boxes above it. And then Matt Doherty was seventh and they had a check mark. Like he was their seventh choice to come coach. That's fantastic.
That was about right. He stirred up some enthusiasm at Notre Dame, but he had the pedal to the metal at all times, and it's hard to
300 the story of the 300 sprints or something. Murphy wrote 300 on his keep rolling from Limp Bizkit, and he had 300 written on his because he made it run 300 sprints at some point. That's insane.
Yeah, that is insane. Question from Maz 1515. Who got the better end of the Max Bulla / James Laurinaitis sweepstakes, Notre Dame or Ohio State?
I'll say Notre Dame, and that's not a knock on Laurinaitis. I just think that where Max is, Max knows exactly what he wants to do. He wants to continue to grow. I think he's an effective teacher. I think he's passionate, authentic. I think he has tremendous runway ahead of him in his career, and I think that Notre Dame got the better of that. I think you see the way that Notre Dame handled it, that Notre Dame believes it got the better of it because it still could have kept Max Bulla around potentially, or tried to keep him as an analyst and gone out and hired a safeties coach and probably would have lost Max very confidently to Boston College in that scenario. But Notre Dame didn't want to risk losing Max and made the necessary adjustments. They got Marty Biagi working a lot with the safeties. I watched him very closely last week. That's certainly something I'll continue to watch. I find very interesting. He has coached Nichols and some of those guys in the past, specifically at Purdue. But Notre Dame prioritized keeping Max Bulla the way that Notre Dame prioritizes some of its prospects in recruiting. And so, yeah, Max Bulla, I think, is a high four-star coaching signee for Notre Dame.
Is there anything to that, what you were saying, JB, that Laurinaitis, is that Max Bulla is more of a coaching lifer in your mind than Laurinaitis?
I do. Yeah, okay. I definitely think that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that Laurinaitis wants to take that next step. And good for him for having a vision of what he wants work life balance and quality to be. And I think he's got some more latitude to do that.
There is no work life balance as a coach.
Right. That's why, like, as an analyst, you have a little bit more control.
Yeah, there just isn't. I would agree. Max Bulla hasn't, necessarily, quote, accomplished anything yet at Notre Dame. Although, again, as we've said, he was the linebackers coach last year. They played well. It was a veteran group. He's going to be tested this time because of all the new names, which I'm excited about because I think it's a good group, but if we had to answer it, we'd point towards Max Bulla right now.
Next question, Irish Boy One. How would you rate Coach Shrewsbury's first season? What grade would it be? I thought JB's best point was how everybody got better. I think Konecny got better over the year, but not over the season because he had a little bit of injury issue too. But I still think he started better than he got in the middle. I wouldn't even let's remove the injury for the end. He was better at the beginning than the middle. So I think he might be the only one, but boy, everybody else. Really some progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Tremendous progress. And again, Kabajai has so much more to improve, but they don't win Tuesday without him going 9-10 at the free throw line. And I know I've already made that point, but that's a guy who's worked on his craft and can be a reliable free throw shooter as your big inside, letter grade. And for JR, his foot injury is pretty significant. It's really interesting that he was able to gut it out and play, I think, with some special orthotics here down the last 2 to 3 weeks of the season. We'll continue to monitor that. I'll see if he has to maybe have an off-season procedure to try to clean that up. I don't know. What do you give him? I don't know. B minus? Just because there was so much promise, but there were a couple of early season games where you're just like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah.
I don't know. I probably give a B minus.
Yeah, something in the B range. I mean, it took him a while to get rolling, but that's understandable. Who's the most improved player on the team? Kerry Booth? Maybe the way the season ended.
Marcus Burton?
Most improved?
Yeah.
I mean, I know he's become. It's hard to think of true MVP like
it is, but
improved. But I would agree. I was going to say Braden Shrewsbury, but I don't think Braden Shrewsbury would think that way because, although he shot, I mean, clearly he shot poorly early on, and then I need to figure out percentage at a certain point the rest of the way because he was a 40. What I mean. The final two thirds of the season, he was a 44% 3-point shooter or whatever he was. I'm not really sure.
But at some point, he looked automatic. There was a week and a half there where it was ridiculous.
I would go with my most improved would be Tay Davis.
Yeah,
that's the way that guy closed the season.
You're right. I mean, I would agree with you. He closed really strong. I had high hopes for him right from the very beginning because he is a 6'9" guy that can handle and take the ball to the hoop, which will become even more valuable when the pieces around him become better. I don't disagree with you, John. I expected that out of him, though. I mean, based upon my conversations with Shrewsbury during the summer, because obviously he knew him better. But, yeah, I the most improved aspect of their team is their team. You know, not individuals. It's their team, the way that they played together, and they bought in, man. I mean, they bought in on the defensive end. Again, I mentioned this in today's Thursday Thoughts. They're in top 50 in the country in scoring defense, top 75, I think, in or maybe 80 in defensive field goal percentage, and then in the top 50 in 150 in the country in rebounding margin, which is absolutely the foundation of a program.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this question's coming up. I'm going to ask this question, then we can answer it because I almost jumped ahead.
Okay.
I told Althea, how do you see the basketball roster changing going into next year?
I wrote about this a little bit in Thursday Thoughts. I mean, obviously, look, a front court, a front line player. That is an extremely attractive opportunity for a bunch of big men out there that want to go from one level of college basketball to another. You look at Notre Dame with their backcourt and their shooting, the shooting that's coming in, Sir Muhammad, Cole Serta, a front court position for a kid at a mid-major is just staring at him to come to Notre Dame and play in the ACC.
You got to retain the three, the Booth. Well, let's go in order. You got to retain the Burton, Davis, Booth trio. You hope you can hold on to your son. That would be kind of rough if he just left. So there's four guys there. I think if Kebba Jai is your backup center playing that defense and rebounding and continues to, you know, work on his offensive game, that is ideal. And then after that, you're recruiting and whoever can bring in better in the portal, you bring in better in the portal. It's let them fight it out. It's fine. There's guys can leave. It's cool. Just don't lose the other ones.
Yeah.
You need lose your son.
You need, I mean, Julian Roper, he did some good things this year defensively and rebounding at times. He needs to play less. Logan Himes, you know, just in the grand scheme of things, he needs to play less.
But for like these two freshmen and for a really good graduate transfer is where you want. Oh, you don't want to get Logan Himes to be you don't want a senior Logan Himes.
No, that's what I mean. I mean, you got to recruit past them, whether it's in the portal or whether it's Serta and Muhammad. I don't believe in Garrett Sundra. I saw one of our subscribers put out a depth chart and had him as a starter. I don't think that he's a frontline starter. He, in my mind, from all the film that I've watched of him, he has a lot more to prove. I think Serta as a shooter and Muhammad is, his all-around game is really, really impressive.
I want to clarify, because I'm not ripping on Logan Iams. I don't want sophomore year Logan Iams to be the guy. I don't want a senior version of the sophomore Logan Iams. If Logan Iams stays with Notre Dame, I would love to have senior Logan Iams helping out Notre Dame's basketball team in 2 and 3 years. That would be great.
Well, we got the question about the Notre Dame wide receiver room. I've made this correlation before on this podcast. When's the last time Notre Dame had a full basketball roster of 13 scholarship guys and 13 guys meaningfully on scholarship, not awarded scholarships after coming as a walk-on and biding some time? So to me, Micah Shrewsbury has to completely fill out his bench. People are asking, and we're talking about the transfer portal, so I'll just go ahead and note, transfer portal opens this coming Monday, March 18th. It will stay open for 45 days until May 1. So that's the big basketball transfer portal window, 45 days. I'll clarify, the football window, I believe, is April 15th through April 29th. But by May 1st, we're going to know a heck of a lot about the future rosters for Notre Dame football and Notre Dame basketball.
And I think Notre Dame will upgrade with a clear frontline player, front court player.
Yes.
And maybe two, because I think there's an opportunity on this team with this roster for a second big to look at Notre Dame and say, yeah, I think that's a really good opportunity there as well. You're right, JB. We will know the future of Notre Dame basketball, or at least 2024, 2025 in pretty short order.
All right. Two questions left.
This is a great one too. Terry Benedict, you're the head football coach. Would you rather sign a 4-star recruit or a 3-star grad transfer?
I'll go first.
I'd like to point out Jaden Harrison was a 3-star grad transfer.
I want a 4-star recruit because I'm going to believe in my ability to develop him, and I'm going to believe that I can keep that person for 4 to 5 years. Grad transfers are nice. You shouldn't have to lean on them. You shouldn't have your program built out of them. And you should believe in, again, your ability to develop, identify throughout the recruiting process that you want this 4-star prospect and that he's going to provide a lasting impact for your program. So for me, it's the 4-star prospect for upside and longevity.
Tim?
Oh.
Yeah. It's a typical O'Malley answer.
Listen, Trebek. You're reading from the cards. You're cheating.
All right, here, let me just roll through this. I want 3-star Ben Skoranek more than I want 4-star Jordan Johnson. It's just the way it goes. Well, you need to get guys that can play also. Yeah. You really need to augment your roster with 8 to 9 to 10 guys that can really play that are grad transfers. But JB's right. You have to also bring in every single year, because you know what else there is? There's always room, 24 to 25 of the highest possible recruits you can. And then they could leave.
Your answer to it, Tim, and I understand where you're coming from, JB, and that's exactly how a confident football staff should view it. I read it the same way, Tim, that, okay, there's a lot of 4-star prospects out there. Do we get one of the good ones?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you get an overachiever as a 3-star grad transfer, or is he truly just a 3-star grad transfer? So I don't know how to answer that exactly, but I think
Freddie Canteen or TJ Jones, I said it the wrong way. I'd rather have the 4-star TJ Jones, to JB's point, but I don't know. Maybe TJ Jones would have been playing for Alabama in 2012 if he was in the portal era.
All right, we're going to wrap this up with a question from Duquesne Duke 23, and that is, should I be excited about this 2024 Irish team as much as I am? I feel this could be a 1988 or 1993 type season.
You should always be excited about the upcoming Notre Dame season, and I encourage you to subscribe to IrishIllustrated.com to read our coverage about it. Pretty good, Jack?
T.O. on fire today. I like this. You're feeling a little sassy today. I like it. Yeah, be excited because it's never been more of a quarterback game, and you have a lot of things enticing about what Notre Dame is doing at the quarterback position. It's year three for Marcus Freeman. It's a more manageable schedule. I'm not convinced it's as easy as some folks believe, and I think you talk about setting a hell of a tone in your opening game on the road in College Station, almost assuredly a night game with 105,000, I think it is, there at Kyle Field. I've been there before. It'll be nuts. They'll be doing their weird chants and cheers and ringing bells and shooting cannons and all that crap that they do. But you're going to set a hell of a tone for your season August 31st in College Station, Texas.
They do have a cheering approach that's different than everybody else. We were actually talking about this before we went on the air, you know, because there's some consternation about the offensive line. And Notre Dame's 1988 offensive line ended up being really, really good. But going into it, there was a ton of inexperience there. But you had Joe Moore as your offensive line coach, so that took care of that. I think so. My point being that the reason that you might not be quite as excited is because I don't know that this offensive line is going to be on the level of those two. But yet you do have a veteran, you know. I mean, look, you have Charles Jagason and Tosh Baker. A good offensive line coach should get productivity out of that group. They don't have to. Would it have been nice to get a frontline offensive tackle in the portal? And they still could, I guess, to some extent. Yeah, but look, Charles Jagason, Tosh Baker, you should get productivity out of those two guys as your offensive tackles. Not along the lines of Joe Alt, of course, and Blake Fisher. But you can be there. I'm excited about it. I think that it, everybody's heard me say, I think it's a top five to top seven preseason team. I agree with you, JB. There's this general assumption that, oh, well, okay, we've got Florida State, Louisville at home, and they're not going to be as good as they were. Okay. They're also a program that now knows how to win, or at least in their minds, they think they know how to win. So those are two games that I think are being taken for granted right now because they're home. And because we expect them to take a step back, which they probably will to some extent, but they're winning programs now and they expect to win. So,
and they've been really, really good with the transfer portal. Florida State done it a little bit longer, but Louisville is committed. Jeff Brohm is getting everyone into school that he wants to get into school. They're being very proactive. So yeah, they're probably going to take a step back, but they're also incredibly well equipped to go shopping in the transfer portal, already have and will be again at the end of April.
And Tim, I agree with you. Notre Dame fans should be excited about every season, right?
But that's a good point by JB that they have a quarterback. If they mess up this quarterback situation, come on now. So I have a lot of faith they're not going to, but you better get a quarterback out of this. But you know what, Tim? You're right. There's six, I count six, not including Pat Coogan, who wasn't a four-star. Six four-star people in the top seven. You can make something work there, going back to our four-star conversation. And when I say that, there's six four-stars, only one of them is an underclassman. It's very easy to say we have all these four-stars at offensive line. It doesn't matter if they're freshmen, because they're not supposed to work out like Joe Alt did. But they have six four-stars, five of them upperclassmen, plus Pat Coogan, to try to make a seven-man group.
And I realize that Billy Shroff needs to play guard, but I think he could play right tackle if things didn't work out and you had to put your five best on the field. I don't want to see that. I'm not a proponent of that, but if push came to shove and Rocco Spindler was one of your best five, you could play him at guard and Billy Shroff. I don't want to see that. Not suggesting that. I don't think that's what's best for Notre Dame or Billy Shroff.
All right. So we have Billy Shroff at tackle. We have Shrewsbury looking at Louisville right now. What else is going on? We don't want any more four-star or three-star grad transfers. We're just going to, no. Anyway, wrapping it up. There you go.
Hey, being it, I will believe this till the day I die. It is a privilege to be a follower of Notre Dame football. I realize that there are a lot of people today that can't find any joy whatsoever in following the University of Notre Dame football team. But for those of us that grew up in this area and take greater pride in what Notre Dame is and what it stands for, it goes beyond.
Yeah,
winning a national title.
I actually want to give Duquesne Duke more credit than I did because I was sarcastic there, but I was. I think I'm excited about this team. I think it'll be a lot of fun to watch. It's a unique. Like remember, I said it's just time to watch some new linebackers. Sarcastically, yeah, it is no, time to watch some new guys. It's time to see Christian Gray and Jaden Mickey. It's time. I mean, Xavier Watts, Riley Mills, Howard Cross, and Jack Kaiser came back to play. Are you kidding me?
That's
insane.
Well, this is a great opportunity. As I mentioned at the top, football picks up again next week, Wednesday, pro day. Opportunities to talk to Notre Dame's line coaches, Marcus Freeman, et cetera. Until then, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, John Bryce, this has been Irish Illustrated Insider.